I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Well, today is a day of anticipation. Across the country, people are voting. Now, in a few statistically insignificant places, the results of those votes are being announced. But really, this is a day of waiting and wondering. A bit like the end of a serialized novel, a story that began some time ago, maybe in a secret society at Yale, or maybe in Florida in the year 2000. Others might argue this narrative started with the attack on September 11th, or in Iraq, or even with the start of this campaign. What's more, we don't really know where or when it's going to end. Perhaps with a victory rally later tonight, perhaps in a courtroom sometime after that. And so we've invited a couple of authors to join us this hour to try to make literary sense of this story, to help us find the narrative of this election. We'd like to have you help us out as well. If you were going to write this story, at least as we know it today, what would it be? Would it be a play, a mystery novel, a country song? And what's the story of the election? Is it a story of two men each trying to overcome adversity in order to win the hand of the princess? Or is it ultimately a larger story about war and morals? Perhaps a battle between the head and the heart? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With me here in Boston, the writer, Gish Jen. Her latest novel is The Love Wife, just out this fall. Nice to have you back in the Connection studio.
It's my pleasure.
And joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. is Thomas Mallon. He's author of Bandbox, just out last spring. Hi, Thomas.
Good morning.
Now, I think we need to kind of adjust the rules a little bit for this program, because normally on The Connection, when we talk about the story, we mean the journalist's story. What's the story in the newspaper? And when we turn to you two as writers, the idea of story is something a little bit different. And if we come at it from that perspective, Gish, I'm going to ask you to start. What is the story of the election? Do we even know yet?
Well, I don't think we do know. And of course, you know, there are lots of ways of writing this story. I mean, that's obvious from the journalist's point of view. It's also obvious from the fictional point of view. I mean, if you were going to write this as a traditional, narrative of using traditional, existing narratives, you might think about this as, Oedipus versus Othello. I mean, sorry, Oedipus versus Hamlet, excuse me,
Okay, so
Oedipus, the fatally flawed hero who
kills his father.
He kills his father, and he continues on in a headlong way, convinced of something that he needs to find, and is undeterrable. And as opposed to maybe Hamlet, I mean, I think there's a way in which the campaigns, at least, would like to paint Kerry as the cerebral man who is unable to act. Now, of course, if you're familiar with the play, of course, Hamlet is much more complicated. It's much more complicated than simply a man who cannot act. But, there is a way in which I think the campaigns would like to see the story that way. I mean, it's not the way that I would write it. If I were to write this, I would have to say that, of course, among other things, you're going to have a pretty serious postmodern overlay, right? I mean, there's a lot of ways in which this is a story about... It's a metafictional story. It's a story about the storytelling, right? I mean, I'm not saying that there isn't, there aren't real issues, but it's also true that, the Karl Rove is the author of the story and also a character in this story. It's very postmodern, something that could come out of Richard Powers or Jonathan's Saffron Foer.
Let me bring Thomas in here, because sure. if we back it up a little bit, Thomas, to figure out what it is that we're looking at in literary terms, is this one where the characters come first and the story is built or stitched around them, or do we have two characters who are somewhat living events however they come to them?
I actually think there's more theme than character in this election. I mean, I say this as somebody who just voted for Oedipus, so I should make that clear. But I think that in many ways this is an election. I don't mean to make it sound so dark, but I think it's fundamentally about revenge. And I think from the Democrats' point of view, rather naturally, there's an element of revenge or avenging because of the 2000 race and the injustice that Democrats perceived there. And I think the Republicans are, running President Bush as a war president, and there's a sense of vengefulness against enemies abroad.
And the confusion perhaps between enemies abroad and enemies at home. I mean, you're with us or you're against us is a way of looking at that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's been somewhat overstated. I think that's been a two-way street. I mean, in terms of the level of invective and so forth. But I think there's a tremendous amount of anger and feeling on both sides that doesn't necessarily reside within the candidates. It's beyond the candidates. And I think one of the things you hear on the Democratic side a lot is a number of voters saying, well, I'm not really passionate for Senator Kerry. Mm-hmm. I admire him. I like him well enough, but I'm not focused on him. I'm focused on the way I want to get rid of this current administration. And Kerry, in a way, has become a vessel or an avatar of people's hopes. And I don't think he has a particularly strong image as a personality to most voters. And I think maybe this is what Gish is talking about, the Hamlet-like aspect, that he's a bit ambiguous to us in a way. Whereas I think the president turned out to be more of a personality than people expected. I think that the people who are irritated by him and angry with him never expected to be so angry or irritated with him when they first were introduced to him in the year 2000.
Or Gish may be more of an identifiable character, something that's easier to define than Kerry?
Yeah, you know, I would agree with Thomas that there's a way in which, you know, that both candidates as characters have been sort of overshadowed by other things. And they've been overshadowed by things like I say, the sort of, you know, the narrative of the narrative. I think that they've been overshadowed by the fact that the voting machines are so important in this election. You know, there's a way in which, you know, apparatuses that, you know, should have been invisible, you know, have been shown to be sort of shaping of the narrative and flawed. You know, here we're living in this era. We've had the death of the author. We've had the death of the grand narrative. We've had the death of authority in general. Now we have
You're getting too far ahead of me. The death of the author. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, in this postmodern time, you know, we have the death of all authorities are shown to be kind of, and you know, non-objective and politically motivated. And there's a way in which, you know, the voting machine has sort of has been caught up in this, you know, so that, you know, voting procedures, you know, used to be assumed to produce something objective and real, you know, a number, a count, right? And now we find that, you know, they've just deconstructed themselves and they've shown themselves to be subjective and a very dubious authority. And there's a way in which that whole story, you know, the story around the story has mm-hmm. kind of obscured the characters just in the way that, you know, when you do look at some of these postmodern narratives, you know, all the characters seem so constructed that we can't even really interest ourselves in them.
And Thomas, this is something that I think that applies to both camps. If you look at the way that the two characters, if we talk about the presidential candidates as characters in this hour, if we look at the way that they have tried to sort of refine or rewrite their own stories and the way that they've used imagery to try and make themselves into things that they're necessarily not. I mean, I'm thinking of the president dressed in the flight suit and John Kerry dressed in the goose hunting, I mean, mm-hmm. suit. It just didn't really fit either of them. And what Gish is saying, I think, here is that everybody sees through the facade this time around.
Well, I think I don't think anybody has ever felt any average voter has ever felt more saturated in an election than this one. And I think I think we're more than usually observant of symbolism and, you know, attempts at manipulation.
Are we more cynical?
Actually, I don't think so. I mean, I had to stand in line for an hour to vote this morning. I would say cynicism would be reflected if in a bad turnout. But I don't think it's cynicism that's driving people to the polls today. I think it's passion that's driving people. And in that sense, I think that this is, for all the ugliness that has been involved in this election. And I know a lot of people who have had, you know, terrific family arguments, marital arguments, you know, have really been at one another's
throats. It's great, isn't it? I mean, the story is that people say, I don't want to talk about the story. Don't bring this up.
News is they're out online today. And I think that's great.
I think you're exactly right on that. I want to take a call from Boston. Nancy's joining us on the line. Hi, Nancy. What do you think?
Hi. If I had to write this election, I'd do sort of a great American epic of the tale of two Americas, because you have one candidate is from an entitled background and acts as if he has a religious sort of enlightened city on the hill view, and as if everyone in America feels that way. And then you have another candidate who is
also from an enlightened an entitled background.
They both have an entitled background, but one, you know, in their own personal life has sort of, you know, just has been entitled, just sort of floats from an oil company, and then he's the governor, and, you know.
So you like to see Carrie in this story as the sort of as the independent who's battling against the person who holds the position of power due to entitlement. Is that what you're saying?
I don't see him also as like this struggling worker person either, but just sort of as the result of a few generations of working his, you know, self into a position of privilege as well, and, you know, acting differently, with different backgrounds. He's sort of more trying to be, with his goose hunting outfit, trying to be more inclusive, trying to be too many things, maybe.
Maybe I'm being too harsh, Kish. I don't know.
You know, I agree with the caller. I do think that this is a battle between two Americas. I mean, there is a way in which I don't think any of us are really sure that, you know, the candidates stand for what we think they stand for, you know, because there is so much image making. But there is another way in which there's a very important, you know, question on the line. You know, whose America is this? You know, does this America belong to, you know, the powerful, to the interest groups, to the rich? Or does America belong to the common man? I do think that's very much on the table.
Thomas.
Well,
I thought you might have something to say there.
I don't think that goose will hunt, frankly. I think that, I mean, I agree with Gish, exactly, that there the whole, you know, we've symbolized this with the red states and the blue states, and the culture war is not an exaggerated term. I think that there exists such a thing going on, but I don't think that it can easily be split into a feeling that one side represents the common man and, you know, another side represents privilege. I just don't think that will work itself out economically or whatever. I mean, I think there are all kinds of ideological fault lines, economic fault lines, and whatever, but I think it's...
But that's not an uncommon way for Democrats to characterize themselves within the sort of political story. Are you saying that it's changed, Thomas?
Well, I think it's not uncommon for Democrats to characterize themselves that way, but I don't think that the Democratic Party has a monopoly on the common man and a monopoly on the aspirations of the ordinary voter. I don't think you would ever have had the phenomenon of somebody like Ronald Reagan if that were the case.
Quick one from you, Gish, because
we're not talking about, you know, Republican Party in general. We're talking about George Bush. And I think that we do have to look at issues like the tax cut and ask ourselves, you know, whether something is, you know, is on the table. So maybe if you don't want to characterize this as a you know, a battle between, you know, the elite versus the common man, we can just look at it as a battle between people who make more than $200,000 a year and people who make less.
All right, Connection listeners, we are at 1-800-423-8255 and trying to take a literary look at this campaign. And you can tell, even as we try to do that, how difficult it is not to slide back down into a conversation about the arguing points of this campaign. But how are you seeing this story of the election? We are, of course, waiting for the end coming in a day or so, but we'd like to hear from you. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection on this voting day, when we're trying to stay away, at least to a certain extent, from rehashing some of the partisan nature of it. We thought we would try and take a look back at this election campaign and a look ahead in somewhat literary terms. How would you write it? When would you write it? Have we ever seen anything like this? And what kind of literary examples can we look back and find either in American culture or American history that give us a little bit of insight into the way that the people and the people behind the people have been behaving in the past few months? Our number for you to join us is 1-800-423-8255. Gish Jen is here with me in the Boston studio. Her latest novel, The Love Wife, is out just last month. Typical American is another one. Mona in the Promised Land, Who's Irish? A collection of short stories she has written. She'll be voting for John Kerry in this election, though we're not going to press her on that. Thomas Mallon has already voted for George Bush in this election. He describes himself as a historical novelist. His latest novel, Bandbox, is set in the publishing world of the 1920s. Dewey Defeats Truman is clearly set in the last century. Henry and Clara at the time of Lincoln's assassination in 1865. So, Thomas, that gives me a chance to ask you, if you were going to write this story in fiction and choose a place in American history to find the setting within which to tell it, how far back would you go, or would you stay right where we are today?
Oh, I think you could do a novel about this election pretty quickly. My instinct would be to, and I think this is usually my instinct where history is concerned, is to take one of the minor characters. I mean, I don't think I'd get up very close to either the president or to Senator Kerry. I don't know whose point of view it might be. Perhaps a blogger. The bloggers sort of came into their own in this election.
So this is a way of telling the story.
Yeah. I mean, I think the minor characters who get swept up into history. I mean, in that novel you mentioned, Dewey Defeats Truman, I wound up writing about people I imagined in Dewey's hometown of Owosso, Michigan. And I tried to tell the story of the election through a love triangle that sort of mirrored it. There's a young woman who's fought over by two men, and one of them is clearly a kind of Dewey surrogate, the other's a sort of Truman surrogate, and they're fighting over her almost as if she's the electorate in the course of the summer of 1948. And, I mean, I frequently think that the minor characters who've had a glimpse of history often offer a novelist the best avenue into big events.
So you put this in the chatter of say, opposing bloggers as a way of, testing that passion that we've seen?
Maybe campaign operatives, low-level staffers. I mean, I think you saw a little of that in something like Primary Colors, which was very popular, you know, a decade or so ago. And, you know, I think elections, I'm surprised we don't have more novels about elections, because if you think of how much courtroom trials have appealed to novelists for generations, it seems to me pretty clear why that is true. They have their own natural narrative and they have an exciting result, you know, a finish. And an election is the same way. It's got to climax. It's got to have a result. At least in theory, it usually has a result on election night. I mean, you know, I hope this election doesn't turn into, you know, another election slash courtroom thriller. But I think it's kind of natural for a novelist to gravitate toward subject matter like this, because there's a narrative line that already exists. I think mostly the difficulty or the trickiness becomes who are going to be the characters and what's going to be the point of view.
Yeah, you know, I would agree with you. I actually think it's great material, too, and that it's probably underused. You know, maybe in terms of this election, I mean, one of the problems is that you do have a reality to deal with, and we do have the problem of the denouement, perhaps, going on way too long. And there is a way that, you know, even the best editor is not going to be able to edit this out.
Do we see this story, then, in historical terms, looking at the war in Iraq? I mean, if we go back through all the sort of detritus of the campaign, there's the argument of the war in Vietnam, which may or may not have been a proxy for the war in Iraq. But is that the central point that we'd agree needs to be perhaps the arc or the starting point for the narrative, Gish?
Well, there is a way in which it's going to have to be a very, very, very important part of the narrative. You know, I mean, starting with, you know, a desire for a coherent narrative, you know, post-Vietnam. I mean, you know, there is a way in which we were hoping this war would be a good war, you know, like the Civil War, World War II, you know. This war was also supposed to be something like Star Wars, you know. There was, you know, it was going to have, supposed to be high-tech and bloodless, you know. It was going to have, supposed to have some of the magic of some of the things we've been hearing on online, like meetup.com. You know, it was supposed to be kind of magical. Instead, it's turned into, you know, Heart of Darkness. You know, there's a way in which you look at Abu Ghraib and instead of discovering that we are kind of highly evolved beings who can fight this new kind of war, we have discovered that we still go to places and discover ourselves to be savages. You know, it's about the horror.
Let's go to back to our lines, to Nags Head, North Carolina now. Carl's joining us on the phone. Hi, Carl.
Hello, Mr. Goff. First, I have to say that you and your comrades are having way too much fun with us.
Well, that's why you're here.
I know. But I had to call because I was so fascinated by this subject, because I've got my story half written already. And what with the analogies and metaphors of the maritime and meteorological things we've experienced this last season, I couldn't help but think of waves lapping on the shore, you know, changing things slowly where people could adjust. But all of a sudden, here we have a season. Four big storms just come right in, and they cut off this mythical peninsula. Let's call it the Floridis or something. And we have the one of the sub-antagonists standing on the shore after the first contest saying, bring it on. And then he gets hit with the other three storms. And no matter how they try, no matter how many jetties they put up, it ends up cutting an inlet and separates the peninsula from the mainland, and everybody sees what happens. And I just think that we could go on with that, and there's just so
kind of hard to avoid the weather in this one, just because as a force, Thomas, I'm going to ask you to pick it up. As a force, it's frequently used as this kind of metaphor for our inability to cope with events that are thrust upon us.
Mm-hmm. And I also think that Florida would be the natural setting for a novel about the 2004 election campaign. And I also think that I would probably begin it on election night 2000, because I do think I agree with you and with Gish that Iraq is very, very central, and I think people should be voting based on what they think of the mm-hmm. war and the justification for the war, and from my point of view, the expansion of freedom that it's brought with all of the pain that has attended it. But the other element I think that can't be overestimated is the residual anger and bad feeling from the 2000 election. And I think maybe Florida would be the place for this novel, and maybe it would have to start back 4 years ago, because I think that's where a tremendous amount of the energy for this election is coming from, particularly among Democrats.
Sort of a domestic fight as well as something that is being driven by events abroad, Gish?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think revenge is a huge theme in this election. I myself might start at, 9/11 and then go back, start a kind of media res.
Everybody's taking notes.
but this is a technical thing.
1-800-423-TALK. That's the number to join us. Next to Chapel Hill, and Sam's on the line. Hi, Sam.
Hi. If I think about this as narrative, I think we have to think about the two principals in terms of the context of their families. Not just the relationship with their fathers, but the larger family context that they grew out of. And along those lines, I think of it in terms of the other major theme I would want to write in would be about ambition and the role of ambition, almost as an infectious agent. I think the story of John Kerry and his early life, perhaps his experiences at Yale and how he became very ambitious at that time. Mm-hmm. But then contrasting that with George W. Bush, who's ambition infected him perhaps later in life and has had a different effect on his life. So those are some of the themes that I'd be interested in exploring.
And Gish, when again you throw this partisan overlay on top of Sam's idea of ambition, you end up with this both sides accusing the other of ambition for ambition's sake and not having the principles that are necessarily there. I think that one cuts both ways, does
yeah,
it not?
I find, the whole discussion about, who's really a politician and, that being a bad thing, I find just completely absurd. I mean, of course, they're both politicians,
But they're both trying to say that the other one is, or the other one is playing politics with something that they're not playing politics with?
No, this is absurd. I mean, I think there is a way in which, Bush particularly tries to paint himself as someone, who is simply, a gut-driven person. And in that way, he speaks to, to a lot of dominant ideas in our culture right now, about the importance of the gut, from Luke Skywalker on down, trust your gut. We live in kind of a very kind of romantic times, very kind of anti-enlightenment you know, Bush's inarticulateness, I think, also speaks to that. I mean, there's a way in which, you know, he's kind of like Billy Budd, if you remember him from Melville, you know, who can't speak. And, you know, somehow his inability to speak makes him seem more sincere, right?
Although, you know, Thomas, I was listening to a couple of British analysts talking about just this aspect of the president earlier this morning on the radio, and they were saying that it is as much a part of his charm as it is a part of what, you know, people can use to discredit him. What about the heart, the gut attached to one candidate and reason and enlightenment attached to the other? Can you see in that?
Oh, sure. And I think that is a gulf between the candidates. And I think in modern times that has been a gulf between Democratic liberal candidates and Republican conservative candidates. And, as an intellectual, I suppose, being part of the chattering classes and book writing class, I'm supposed to worship at the temple of nuance and complexity. But I would have to say my experience as just a citizen within the body politic over the last 20 years inclines me to say, spare me from nuance and complexity. I constantly heard Reagan described as inarticulate and oafish and knowing only a few little things and being unable to perceive the nuances of events. And I think Reagan moved the world. I would prefer a conviction politician to a politician who is seeking consensus or is, seeking to split the difference. Jimmy Carter, they said, had read every line of the Air Force budget. I'm sure Ronald Reagan never cracked the book, but I know that Ronald Reagan was better for the Air Force than Jimmy Carter was. And This is like
the hedgehog and the fox?
Yeah, absolutely. And I find this election very reminiscent of 1984, when people were horrified that Reagan hadn't met with a Soviet leader in 4 years. We were heading toward apocalypse and repression and so forth because Reagan was so blind and so obstinate. And I think his obstinacy changed the world tremendously and changed it for the better in the 5 years that followed.
You know, but I have to say that I think that this whole idea that somehow, Bush is a man of integrity and, you know, who speaks from the gut, and that, you know, and that Kerry is an intellectual who only knows nuance and has no feeling is a completely false dichotomy. I mean, I think that Bush is probably a far smarter man than he appears. And I think that Kerry also has a lot of conviction. And I just think the whole thing is really, I think this is something where the media has really done us a disservice. I think that we are kind of a Manichaean culture. I think we like to see things in terms of opposites. I think that in a lot of his talk, Bush especially supports that. And yet it's simply not true. You know, I've often sort of wondered, you know, whether Kerry would have fared better, you know, in a culture that had, you know, other tropes and other ways of looking at things, you know. And like in China, you know, the metaphor of the bamboo, you know, is something which bends but does not break, is very important. And I'm sort of often wondering, God, you know, if we had that metaphor to reach for in our press, would Kerry have been maligned the way that he has?
Is it the media, or is it the people who read and consume this story, though, who desire the simplicity that seems to be something that Bush offers as attractive? I mean, he himself speaks about this.
Yeah, he does. And I you're right. I mean, we do have to, finally fault the electorate. You know, I mean, the fact is the American culture has this tendency to think that way, although we are evolving, you know. When I look at all the yoga classes, I think, you know, there is hope. And there is a way, too, I have to say that if I were writing
all
this
the bumper
story,
stickers on all the Volvo outside all the yoga classes.
There is a way in which, if I were writing this story, you know, I would probably write it as a coming-of-age story. You know, there is a way in which, you know, the dominant trope in American culture.
This is a country coming of age story.
A country coming of age. You know, but, you know, our dominant trope has been the adolescent male, you know, this kind of barely socialized figure. There is a way in which, you know, I would hope that the crisis of 9/11 would make us move on, would make us realize that, you know what I mean, it is time for maturity.
I'm coming to you on that in just a few moments, Thomas, but I want to get back to our colleagues because we have a number this morning. To Savannah, Georgia next. Jonathan's on the line. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey.
What do you think?
I actually think this is like the pinnacle of like a Mark Twain, who was one of my heroes, type of story of Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer. Bush being the Tom Sawyer kind of pulled along by events, wasn't, you know, because on his trip up the Mississippi, it was the events that he encountered that made the character so great. and Carrie be more like the, you know, the, you know, character, a good person kind of pulled along by the other characters in the story. So that's how I really could see this as a great American, you know, that became a mythology type of ideal.
Thomas, I've heard the comparison. Sorry, Jonathan, was I cutting you off?
I was just wanting to see what your two authors would think about, you know, how Tom Sawyer, Huck Finn, maybe even the Mark Twain, you know, point of view. He's, you know, Mark Twain was very cynical, and this is how the election has gotten very cynical. So I wanted to see how they saw that. Or
it was, in fact, Tom Sawyer, Thomas, who took us all to the cave in the first place. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's...
I don't know. Senator Kerry sometimes reminds me a little of Sid in Tom Sawyer, Tom's sort of goody-goody relative that he's got to compete with for Aunt Polly's approval. But I don't know. I think both of these men, the caller, I think it was Sam a couple of calls back, who talked about the different points in their lives when each of these men reached maturity and, in particular, reached a kind of ambitiousness that happened earlier with Senator Kerry, later with President Bush. I think that is interesting, too. And I think as I say, for all my talk of how I think theme trumps character in this election, I think it is an election about great issues and ideas. But, you know, there are enormous personal ironies with both of the men and with the things they believe. I mean, the president 4 years ago ran on a foreign policy that was in many ways going to be more modest and consultative, quiet, unassuming. But events changed him. And Senator Kerry is running as if his Vietnam experience was the most important qualification he had.
I have to stop you there, Thomas. We're coming up to a break here. Connection listeners, is it events? Is it characters? Is it? Do we find our links in folklore, in folktales, or in something more intellectual, in some way that this country is changing when we look at the story, the narrative of this election? 1-800-423-8255. That's the number to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection, and you're going to be reading an awful lot about this election and its campaign. First of all, written by journalists, then written by historians. This hour on the program, we're taking a more literate look at how the story of this election, this campaign, these two men, what it is that they stand for, what it is that they say they stand for, and how we see that in more literate terms or more cultural terms. We'd like to have you join us. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. We're going next to Rocky Mountain, North Carolina. Allie's on the line. Hi, Allie.
Hi.
So, what do you think?
What do I think? Well, like you were talking about earlier, how that the actually the ballots have become, you know, the focus of the election and not the campaigns. I would like to have my story kind of feel in that respect, that people that are involved with campaigning for the election will be the focus, not the actual candidates, and how kind of the personal damage that each side does to each other, and that warring Republicans and warring Democrats are causing more pain than, you know, the candidates are to the reverse side. And I would like to have my story kind of come to a climax when, you know, with the Republican victory, and like something like 60% of Americans are in their home crying, very upset. The other side is completely elated and showing that, you know, we are a divided nation, but we are the ones that are dividing ourselves. The candidates aren't doing it yet, but we are. And then I would like to end it with the Democrats trying to force the Electoral College be gone, and that's just to go by the popular vote. And in doing so, in the 2008 election, Kerry will run the campaign for people with living within a city of a population over X amount
Allie, I want to stop you there because I'm getting a little bit lost in the story, and I'm going to stick with the part that where you had me, and that was in this way that people, not candidates, and not Karl Roves, not the Machiavellian behind-the-scenes people, but just ordinary Americans, Thomas, are as much a part of the antagonism here. What do you think? I mean, are people responding to what they see and what they read and what they hear, or are people also acting out their own really distinct sense of what the country is?
Well, I think the candidates reflect the people. I mean, that sounds very Pollyanna-ish in a way, but I don't think it's simply the fact that, you know, we're presented with these two candidates and very passively, you know, we've got to choose between them. I think the reason you have President Bush facing Senator Kerry now is that, by and large, these are the candidates that the country wants. I mean, Senator Kerry does represent those blue states, and the president does represent those red states, and they got there through primary victories in the case of Senator Kerry, and you know, obviously the president had incumbency, but the president fought his way through the primaries back in 2000, and I think we get the candidates that, you know, we want and deserve, and I look forward to a time when we're less at one another's throats. I don't think that this has been a happy 6 months at all. But I think that, you know, the stakes are enormous and the issues are very, very real this time. And I think that I think we've got to keep sight of the fact that, you know, we're friends. As you know, as President Lincoln said in 1861 in his first inaugurals, we must not be enemies, and we are not enemies. We're friends across this cultural divide, and we all have much more in common than we have against one another. But I think that these are our candidates. I think they came from us. I don't think we're our behavior is coming from them.
So, have then citizens created this high noon kind of standoff in politics where everything is in opposition to, you know, one half is in opposition to the other half, and there isn't that common ground?
You know, I would say, I would agree with Thomas that, you know, this election is very much about the human heart in conflict with itself, as Faulkner would say. I mean, in that way, it's quite a wonderful narrative, and it's exciting to see so many people galvanized by it. So, right, it is the right conflict. It is our conflict. You know, it's interesting your question about high noon. I'm not sure exactly what you're getting at. I would say that that story has been very influential, not so much, I think, when I think about the election, but when I think about the war. You know, High Noon is the movie, you know, the single movie which is most viewed in the White House. And, you know, there is a way in which, you know, I feel like a lot of Bush's, you know, unilateral action was influenced by this, you know, this very important American trope of the individuals, you know, standing up to the mob. I think the folly there, though, for my Democratic point of view, is that, you know, I'm not sure that, you know, even if it was a good idea for, you know, one person to stand up to a mob, you know, stand up to a mob in the Wild West, I don't know if it was a good idea then, but it's certainly not a good idea today, you know, in the international arena. I just see this as just an unbelievable mistake. And I do think that is, you know, one of the things that we're struggling with. I mean, as a nation, you know, that is the way that we think. You know, the individualism is such an important part of our fabric. And yet I think that we're kind of standing at a crossroads and beginning to realize that maybe that just doesn't work in our world now.
All right. I want to go next to Donaldsonville, Louisiana, and Nova's on the line. Hi, Nova.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. It's a great show, and I listen to it all the time.
Well, nice to have you here. What are you thinking?
Well, I'm thinking the narrative is on a latter-day Confederate fantasy or, fantasy-type line. It's filled with irony in that Bush, because of his inarticulate nature, because he was president of Deke and then ultimately, I guess, had to join AA or whatever got him off the sauce, I think he is seen as the underdog figure, even though he's the incumbent.
Well, he likes that, does he not? He characterizes himself in a way as a even as president, as a, you know,
yeah,
battling against the establishment.
Right, and I think he succeeded. But there may be something a little more sinister in that if there's a complete, if all three branches of government are Republican, or let's say not just Republican, but on the Bush and administrative mold, then it would be a great triumph. I think he's seen as a kind of a Johnny Reb character by many an unreconstructed Confederate. And I think that there's an undercurrent. It's probably completely unconscious. But I think that he is seen as the folk hero who can resist the sophisticated Yankee.
What do you think, Thomas?
Oh, I think there's an element in that. I think another irony of the president is, of course, he does come from a fairly patrician New England background, but by now he is the ultimate Texan, and he's very authentically so. And I think if you look at the movement from generation to generation within the Bush family, you're seeing something about the country. You're mm-hmm. seeing the shift in power in the country from the Northeast to the South and Southwest. And
in this color comparison, can we look at red-blue in 2004 and find parallels with blue-gray in Civil War times?
I hope it hasn't come to that, that it's that extreme, but
wasn't actually thinking about people taking up arms against one another, but more a sort of different understanding, the two Americas that we were talking about
sure.
earlier in the program.
And, I mean, you've always had splits, really fundamental splits about what the country was supposed to be, the Jeffersonian vision of an agrarian America versus the Hamiltonian vision of a more industrialized urban America. And I think these kind of very fundamental cultural differences are always going to persist. But I think that even though they're part of what is driving the election, what really ought to be driving the election is the foreign policy of the country, from my point of view right now. I think that Democrats who are voting for Senator Kerry should be voting because they disagree with what the president's doing in Iraq, and the people who support the president should be coming out for him because of what's going on there. And I would have to say one other election night that I'm in some ways looking more forward to than tonight is an election night in January when the people in Iraq will go to vote.
Kishchen, I wanted to get you in on this notion of I missed Nova's call, I should say, from Louisiana when she takes this back to the late 19th century, and just to see whether or not there's anything there that kind of resonates with you.
You know, it does resonate with me, but also I will say that, like Thomas, for all that we have these kind of tropes and we can, you know, and this, of course, sort of part of the reason we're here today is to look at kind of the influence of these tropes on our behavior. I hope that by, you know, bringing this to light, you know, realizing that we do kind of have these narratives and they kind of influence the way we see things, that we will, like, you know, we will be able to kind of set them aside and realize, like,
not slide back into
not
the
old, you know,
reactive.
Exactly. We may have these tropes, you know, we may kind of have this gut level reaction to certain kinds of stories. The same way we've got level reactions, you know, to guns, gays, and God, but that's not what this election is about. I'm with Thomas on this one. You know, this election is about foreign policy. It's about real issues. We cannot let these tropes govern our behavior.
Back to the phones, to Boston. Jennifer's with us on the line. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi there. Thank you for humoring me. my story is a science fiction story. In it, we're in a tightly contested race like we are today, and we have our protagonist who's maybe he's a journalist or someone else like that who's found something out that's going on. He's gotten a whiff of something. He's found out a secret. He's someone who has dubious credibility. Maybe he's a conspiracy theorist or, you know, he's always crying wolf or whatever. And in the meantime, of course, the bad guys are trying to kill him.
I need the executive summary here, Jennifer.
Oh, sorry. Basically, the election's over, and we have a winner and a loser, and we find out the next day that the winner and the loser are the same people. And they were basically, it's a robot, and the American electorate is just chosen, you know, this robot, and all the decisions going forward are going to be made by this master governmental computer program anyway. So
I'm thinking back, Gish, to the moment after the debate when all the speculation was not on what had been said by these two candidates, but what the bulge in the back of one candidate's jacket might have meant for the future of the country. Because what Jennifer, you know, gets us doing is thinking about all those kind of side stories, the you know, what is it that we should be searching for? What are we missing? I got to make my vote, but what piece of information don't I have? What's the story that's not being told?
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, but there's a kind of an underlying paranoia there, too, you know, which I say, to me, that's just one more thing that we need to get rid of. You know, we may have these ideas like, you know, possibly, you know, there's a robot really, you know, behind it all. I just don't think that those kinds of narratives are going to serve us.
But the political parties at their worst fuel that.
They do, you know, and all this talk about the storytelling, you know, fuel the idea that there's no reality, but there is a reality. you know, ask people in Baghdad, there is a reality. And we really need to kind of keep focused on that and not just be kind of reacting.
Thomas?
I think it's true that the political differences this time out have been so sharp that I think everybody has been in arguments with friends across the barricades and have at times almost begun to think, well, we're not even talking about political differences here. We're talking about almost cognitive differences. Like, how can you possibly see this that way? You know,
how can you see him that way?
Yeah, the same set of data, the same set of facts. How can you possibly see that this way? I mean, if you think of the ferocious debates about something like Fahrenheit, you know, 9/11, which to some people is just arrant propaganda and to other people is very persuasive. It's almost a question of cognitive differences between people. That's how profound I think the political differences are. And I hope that that heals somewhat.
Though how do we address that in an election, Gish?
I don't know what to say, but it is true. I've actually had the same idea, you know, that, you know, if we could run MRIs on people, that we would be able to see, you know, the Bushies are going to light up in one way and, you know, the Currys are going to light up in a different way. Or, you know, if you think of some, you know, I don't know if you know the Myers-Briggs perception test, you know, I think the last, you know, thing is, you know, are you a judging person or perceiving person? And I do think the judging person, you know, judging people are going to vote one way and the perceiving people are going to vote a different way.
You both said earlier in the program that maybe we should use the politics in this country as the fodder for more writing, and you have persuaded me that we do need to do that. Gish, I want to thank you for coming in.
It's such a pleasure.
Gish Jen is author of The Love Wife most recently, and Thomas Mallon, thanks again for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Thomas is author of Banned Box. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.